Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide and today on The Wire.
We can change this around and we can do it quite quickly, but it has to have several parts of a recipe to make it happen.
A call to change the menu for aged care residents to help with both physical and mental health. And
part of their profit model is a benefit from people getting hooked on material and going down a rabbit hole of more and more extreme material. And whilst we're asking them to completely throw away that business model of clicks and traffic, they need to put limits around where it goes.
We continue our series, Anti-Social Media Extremism in the Online World, with a look at how social media companies moderate against extremist content. Also today, Indigenous knowledge sought to help conserve the Great Barrier Reef, and as Kevin Spacey is let off the hook, where to now for Me Too? Stay tuned for the next half hour. Indecent assault charges were dropped yesterday against Kevin Spacey in relation to an incident in which he allegedly groped an 18-year-old barman in Nantucket, Massachusetts in 2016. A corresponding civil case was also dropped earlier this month. Both cases were abandoned following accusations that the complainant had deleted text messages that are believed to constitute a critical piece of evidence. The Wire's Ben D'Andrea asked Kelly Toole, lecturer at the University of Adelaide, while charges are often dropped in cases of sexual offences.
It can be any number of things. It's mostly related to the evidence that's been obtained. Perhaps the police weren't able to get as much evidence as they thought, or perhaps, especially in a case like this, which relies a lot on witness evidence, maybe the witnesses have changed their mind or changed their story or don't want to go ahead or don't appear to be as compelling as they thought. This case is a bit different to most because it seemed to rest on text messages in the phone, and it does appear as though the complainant or his mother had actually tampered with the telephone that was given to police. So this is quite unusual compared to how most of these matters proceed.
And so does this mean, for example, that Kevin Spacey is innocent?
Not at all. And it doesn't mean in the majority of cases that the complainant is being dishonest. It just means that with the evidence that the police are able to obtain, they're not likely to be able to get a conviction. So it doesn't say one way or another whether Kevin Spacey is guilty or innocent.
There were over 250 high-profile individuals accused of sexual misconduct between April 2017 and December last year. Yet there have been very few convictions or even trials. Do you think that high-profile figures are less likely to go to trial or be convicted because of their fame or fortune?
The issues mostly relate to evidence. With high-profile ones, you've always got that power and the fact that people be so interested and you could be vilified on social media. Or it just might be that there's a lack of actual evidence, especially in sexual assault cases. Again, the Spacey one was a bit unusual because there were the text messages, which were not necessarily the most compelling evidence in the world because they were just by the complainant. But they were still a piece of evidence. In most cases, there won't even be that. So you've just got the testimony of two people. And if there's any doubt, the matters are always resolved in the favour of the defendant because the prosecution bears the burden of proof. So mostly it comes down to evidence. I think it's just that the high-profile ones get the publicity and it in fact speaks to the broader problem of people not making complaints. A lot of particularly sex cases will be between people who know each other, so you've got another completely different set of problems of do people want to upset relationships, do they still want to be in a partnership with a person, is it a family member that's going to cause huge family issues, or if it's on the other end of the spectrum, is it a stranger and you're going to have trouble identifying them? So these issues of evidence are absolutely across the board.
And it sounds like there's a mix of social and legal issues here. Can any of these be easily overcome?
Definitely not easily. We'd have to certainly take the view that they can be resolved, but it's going to have to be a combination of legal, procedural and social issues, and changing attitudes is probably the hardest out of any of them.
Do you think there is the public will to take these steps?
I think there is a great deal of will. I mean, it's a kind of uncontroversial that everybody wants sexual offence cases to be prosecuted fairly and get good outcomes. So I think the will is there. It's just the complexity of the interrelated problems that make it so difficult to find a solution.
Despite the low likelihood of any criminal convictions resulting from the Me Too movement, do you think that it still had an important effect?
Yeah, I do think it's had an important effect because it's just been a way of highlighting the breadth of the problem. And even people who factor in perhaps overestimate the number of false allegations, I don't think anybody could suggest that the amount of complaint that's gone on, some of which has been conceded, so it's not as if it's all even open to the interpretation of false allegations. Some people have been accused of misconduct, whether criminal or less than that, have admitted their behaviour and apologised. So in that sense, it has got the scope of the problem more widely known and given support for people who want to come out and make complaints, whereas they wouldn't have necessarily done that on their own, or in fact demonstrably wouldn't have done it on their own. Some people have been silent for decades. So I think it has had that advantage. I think you always do need to be very careful about not going through the criminal proceedings, and it's a dilemma because going through criminal proceedings is manifestly ineffective a lot of times, and yet just having people accused publicly, you can end up with trial by media instead of trial by court, and that's by no means a guarantee of a fair outcome either.
Kelly Toole, law lecturer at the University of Adelaide, speaking with The Wire's Ben D'Andrea. Wherever you are on Indigenous and community radio around Australia, hello, I'm Sarah Martin and you're with The Wire. Fresh herbs, butter, leafy greens and sizzling bacon and hearty cuts of beef may seem like the ideal meal at the pub. But what if aged care residents had this to look forward to every night? This week, celebrity chef Maggie Beer is advocating to make this a reality in an impassioned speech for the Royal Commission into Aged Care. She's encouraging all aged care facilities to adopt a greater quality of food for its residents. The Wise Annabelle McKinnon spoke to Maggie Beer today.
We have to be asking the residents what makes them feel familiar, what brings them memories of home, but we also have to underpin that with the right nutrition in those recipes too.
The Royal Commission into Aged Care has shown that some facilities spend as little as $7 a day on food for each resident. Celebrity chef Maggie Beer says that this is utterly unacceptable.
At $7 a day, the homes, the cooks, the chefs will have to be using processed foods, frozen vegetables, boosters, not making things from scratch. And as the dietitians and nutritionists said in the panel after me at the Royal Commission, it will not have sufficient protein and nutrition for the residents.
How do you think that contributes to their quality of life?
Oh, there's a huge impact on quality of life, giving the right nutrition, but nutrition without flavour is not good enough, because where is the pleasure in that? But if they don't have the right protein, for instance, they lose muscle mass, they're more susceptible to immune diseases, they don't have the energy to be physically involved, and it's unconscionable that it should be so. We can change this around. And we can do it quite quickly, but it has to have several parts of a recipe to make it happen, and that is training, budgets, and give those in aged care that are working so hard and want to do better, give them the tools that they need to work with.
So you think that they can get more involved with food preparation?
Without a reasonable budget, you know, their hands are tied. They want to do better, so they have to have the budget so they can have the fresh vegetables, so they can make their own stocks, so they don't have diet cordials, but they have lovely drinks for hydration, so they have natural supplements rather than bought supplements, so they can infuse their food with lots of extra eggs and cheese and butter and things that will be luscious to taste to give the goodness to someone who is malnourished. But most of all, we have to have the smells of home cooking, those aromas that excite the appetite and be an emotional trigger that it's mealtime for those that have dementia. And even if you're cooking for 100 people, you can absolutely do that. When you're given the skills, the tools, the support and the budget, it's all possible.
Are you hopeful for change soon?
Yes, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful because the Royal Commission has made this a public statement of what is happening, and so no one in the community can avoid it. And that's what we need, for people to know so we can make things better.
Liz, which is not her real name, has worked as a nurse in aged care for over a decade in regional SA. While she agrees with Maggie Beer that there is plenty more to be done, Liz says it's not just a black and white issue. But in fact, there is a lot more assessment that goes into a resident's meal than what meets the eye.
I mean, a lot of people, you are feeding them, you are spooning food into their mouth. And so, I mean, it is important that it smells nice and the temperature of the food and all of those things. It is important because eating is a sensory experience. And it also has to be a nutritious experience as well. So it's not just about sitting down to a normal plate of food. Everything is assessed in aged care for risk.
What is the process of finding a suitable diet for a resident in aged care?
Well, every resident who comes into aged care is assessed when they arrive. It's all based on how well they can swallow, and if there are any complications with that, then they're referred to a speech pathologist, and then the dietitian becomes involved. There's a normal diet for someone who has no difficulty at all with swallowing and chewing. Someone can be on a soft diet, so there's not much chewing involved with that. Some people can be on a pureed diet, so there are no difficulties at all with swallowing.
So do you think that would contribute to the quality of food if they are only living on a pureed diet?
Yes, it would. It would contribute to that because a pureed meal doesn't look as presentable as what a normal diet does, as a normal plate of food does that isn't pureed, that hasn't been modified. But unfortunately, the resident's safety has to come first and foremost.
Aged care worker Liz finishing that report from The Wire's Annabelle McKinnon.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
The Great Barrier Reef Foundation has announced it will invest $10 million of its funding to the traditional owner Reef Futures Fund. The $1 million investment over the next 5 years will go towards traditional owner reef projects to allow them to continue their protection activities and pass on their knowledge to the next generation. The Wire's Georgina McKay spoke to Karen Earhart, Program Manager at the Great Barrier Reef Foundation for the Traditional Owner Partnership, about this significant agreement.
This is a really important opportunity for traditional owners of the Great Barrier Reef. And what we see this opportunity being is that a futures fund will be run and delivered by the traditional owners themselves. And so their aspirations and their needs that they want for their sea countries can actually be directly funded and sponsored by the money that's actually generated from the Futures Fund.
How does the foundation plan to work closely with the traditional owners?
So the Great Barrier Foundation is going to work very closely with traditional owners. In setting up the fund, it's actually a co-designed piece where not only does the Great Barrier Foundation have the investment into this space, but what we're going out and doing is we're actually talking to as many of the traditional owners along the coastline as we can, and we've also got a traditional owner working group, and together what we're doing is actually defining what the Futures Fund will look like, what it will do, how it will operate with all of its structures and that sort of thing. And by having that co-design initiative, it brings us all close together, and what traditional owners actually need and want can actually be delivered. So the Great Barrier Foundation is finding that a very important thing to do, to actually hold up their end of the relationship they want to foster with traditional owners.
What are the key issues you hope to target as part of this partnership?
People want to improve the capacity and skills that they have in some different areas, like sea country management, where they might be able to access money for training or for education. Something that's been raised a lot has been, wouldn't it be amazing to have a way of helping the younger generation to access career development money so they could go to TAFE or they could go and be marine biologists at university and move into those higher level skilled jobs. And actually, when we look about managing the Great Barrier Reef, being at the same level playing field as other scientists and managers.
How do you plan to manage and combat the threat climate change will have on the reef?
I think a really important issue to understand when managing the Great Barrier Reef and suffering from the effects of climate change is that traditional owners are regional managers and they are the original owners of the Great Barrier Reef. And if we're going to have a serious attempt at managing the impacts on the reef and save it from human development or climate change, we need to be all working together. And traditional owners have a very good, intimate knowledge of their sea country that's been there for thousands of years.
Do you think more government intervention is needed in order to help the reef?
It's up to the government. I think it's up to local communities. I think it's going to be sitting with traditional owners, and I think everybody is going to have to play their part. And I don't think anybody can turn their back on the investment that the reef is going to need in the next few years just to help it maintain its health. And we want to make sure that it's healthy and resilient and it's in the very best shape it can be.
Is there still hope we can save the reef?
In my opinion, absolutely. We've got a large number of people who live along the reef. We have over 70 traditional owner groups that are saltwater people that are connected intimately to the reef. And I think that it will be people power, and I think there will be innovation, and as well as people who actually care a lot about the reef.
Karen Erhart, Program Manager at the Great Barrier Reef Foundation for the Traditional Owner Partnership, speaking to The Wire's Georgina McKay. This is The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio across Australia. And hello if you're listening in Canberra on 2XX, in Byron Bay on Bay FM, and if you're on the Karma Radio Network in Kintore on 102.9 FM. Last week, we heard the first episode of Anti-Social Media, Extremism in the Online World, a four-part series by The Wire's Ben D'Andrea. In the first episode, Ben explored how extremists use social media to advance their causes. In the second instalment of this series, Ben investigates how social media companies enforce their codes of conduct and moderate against extremist content with varying degrees of success.
Early this year, following an attack on two mosques in Christchurch, the Australian government passed the Criminal Code Amendment, Sharing of Violent Abhorrent Material Act 2019. This act is one of many around the world that seek to impose stricter rules on social media. Even with increasing government intervention, social media platforms are predominantly governed by their own internal codes of conduct and moderation procedures. Elise Thomas, researcher at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's Cyber Policy Unit, describes the methods and shortcomings of social media self-moderation.
They are all separate companies and they do have different policies and procedures and thresholds. So, for example, Facebook's policy on nudity may be quite different from Twitter's policy on nudity. And the same thing applies to extremist content, or sort of content which some people would consider extremist and on other platforms might be allowed.
What are the shortcomings of their procedures when it does come to moderating what would generally be considered as extremist content?
First and foremost, what counts as extremist is often in a grey zone. So there's some stuff which is, I think most ordinary people would say, is very, very clearly out of line. But there's also a lot of stuff which sort of exists in a bit of a grey space. When they use automated systems, trying to get that balance right is very, very difficult because text-based analysis will pick up, for example, some particularly violent words. But if the user decides to use euphemisms or code words, then text-based analysis may not pick up that. And you sort of have different issues if you're looking at automated filtering of video content like we saw with the Christchurch shooting. So, for example, what happened there is that these social media platforms created hashes of that content, and hashes being sort of like a digital fingerprint of visual content. But what happens is that maybe you change the size of it, maybe you slightly change the colour, you sort of fiddle with the sound a little bit in a way that will break the hash. You can play content which looks effectively exactly the same to the human eye, but the computer can't recognise it.
And are these common techniques used by extremist groups to get past moderation procedures?
Oh, absolutely, but they're not only used by extremist groups, they're also used for copyright violations. So if you've ever watched a video on YouTube and noticed the sound was a little bit weird, that's why. So it's the same process.
Why don't platforms put more resources into moderation, considering the very real impacts of content like the Christchurch shooter's video?
I think that's a question that you'd have to ask them. I think they will probably put substantially more effort into it now that there is so much pressure coming on to these companies. And I think in fairness, it is a very difficult challenge. But as you sort of implied, they do have enormous resources and they could be working much harder on this.
Elise Thomas, researcher at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's Cyber Policy Unit. Not all of the challenges of moderating against extremist material are technical, however. Dr. Isaac Fear, director of the National Security Program at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, describes several equally complex challenges that confront social media companies when trying to address extremist material.
It has become a little bit, I think, easier to blame social media for the spread in violent extremist content. I would suggest that over the last couple of years, social media companies have really tried to develop systems and methods, including adopting AI, to try to remove as much violent online content as they possibly can. The challenge that they have is twofold. One, it's very difficult to define what is extremist or radical content, because what you might see as extremist or as radical, somebody else may not. There's also, of course, the argument of freedom of speech, right? You know, we should be able to say certain things even if they're unpleasant. This is the very essence of a democratic society. So that's one challenge that these companies face. The second challenge that they face is that the activists, those who are engaged in the promotion of violent extremist content, have become much smarter. So they use a variety of tools to confuse or to mislead those who are entrusted with removing the extremist content.
Dr. Isaac Fear, director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's National Security Program. For companies the size of Google and Facebook, it's hard to believe that these challenges are too great to overcome. Greg Barton, professor of global Islamic politics at Deakin University, argues that despite the difficulties, social media companies should be doing more to combat online extremism.
The volume of material is such that we're never going to be able to deal with it unless we have approaches that begin with algorithms and automated routines, kind of artificial intelligence, because you just can't have enough human resources throwing at the problem initially. And it's harder to do that with hateful extremist material than it is to do it with pornography, for example. So no one's pretending it's easy. But having said that, one of the great concerns about the social media companies is that their whole business model is built around driving clicks and driving traffic through things. And they have algorithms to drive content to people. And the perverse outcome of that is that in a very automated artificial intelligence fashion, if somebody starts looking at material which is a bit extreme, a bit edgy, the algorithms will deliver to them more and more extreme material, and it becomes a vicious circle. Now, technological companies struggle with that, but they need to face up to the fact that part of their profit model is to benefit from people getting hooked on material and going down a rabbit hole of more and more extreme material. And whilst we're not asking them to completely throw away that business model of clicks and traffic, they need to put limits around where it goes. It's hard to do, but they can do it better than they have been doing, clearly.
Greg Barton, Professor of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University, ending that report by The Wire's Ben D'Andrea. And you can hear the third part in our series next Thursday on The Wire. it for The Wire today. If you'd like to hear any of our stories again or have your say on our stories, head to our website, thewire.org.au. There you can also sign up to podcasts of the show so you never miss an episode. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio. It's all one word. This show is a team effort by 2SER, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and we are supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. And you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide, and I'm Sarah Martin. Thanks for your company.